So it's a second grader in Tarzana, California, in San Fernando Valley. I remember joining with my classmates each morning, standing straight and with full attention, hand over our hearts. This was all preparatory to the morning recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance. And I couldn't say why at the time, but I really disliked this part of the day. I felt acutely uncomfortable, as though I was being deceitful about something very important. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Now, I was 7, and I couldn't understand why these words were part of my school day. Homeroom, I understand. Recess, I got. Learning made sense to me. I did not understand these words, though. I was a little worried that I was doing it wrong, and I was maybe slightly paranoid enough to wonder who was watching me to make sure I was doing it right. But there was such gravity behind this pledge. So the reverence that I heard for these words did very little to calm my young soul. And I wondered what was wrong with me. I looked around, and the other second graders looked perfectly cool with this activity. Some of them even closed their eyes, and it looked like a form of ecstatic prayer. I felt confused, and I felt like an outsider. I realized at this moment that it probably was my first hint that I was a UU, but let's go on. 41 years later, that discomfort remains. When I hear the national anthem, tears spring to my eyes, but I don't sing along. I'm touched by the notion of it, but I can't join in. Because our freedom grants us the privilege as Americans. It grants us the privilege of veering from the script. As a nation and as individuals, we are free in so many ways to claim our individual truths. We are free in a way so much of the world is not, to write, speak, proclaim, and otherwise put forth our unique ways of understanding the world. We're free to be rule breakers, individualists, and contrarians, because we're a free people. At least that is true for the white landed gentry. Our national history tells a story so different from these patriotic words, from these aspirational ideas. Anyone here besides me that remembers learning about the 1787 Constitutional Convention in school? I see heads nodding. This is my historical interpretation. White men of means and education, just white men, came together to form the basis of the governance that we still live with today. That convention and the words created there created the basis both for our political system and our national identity. And in some ways, the United States felt then much as it does now. It felt a bit like an oligarchy with power concentrated in the hands of relatively few. Religiously speaking, the Calvinistic theology of the Puritans ruled the land. And what this means in English is that there was this notion of God's select few, those God favored. Does anyone want to guess who God favored at that time? White men of means. And our Unitarian ideals weren't birthed yet. This one had happened for another 30 years. At the time of the convention, Unitarianism had not broken away from traditional Christianity. So the notion, our universalist notion of commitment to salvation for all, that belief that precludes our commitment to the inherent worth and dignity of all, this wasn't in public consciousness yet. So I wish I could say that the time of the convention laid the groundwork. that led to the land of the free and the home of the brave. That wasn't so. In what we now understand as systemic racism, what happened instead was the Three-Fifths Compromise. Now, the Three-Fifths Compromise, for anyone that doesn't remember, deemed that the freed slaves, a single freed slave, a male, because women weren't even on the radar screen, but a male, African-American freed slave, was worth three-fifths of a white man. This compromise set forth the notion that we still live with, that not all humans are created equal. And this set the stage. Again and again, our national history veers quite sharply from the truths we aspire to. People of color, women, and others have traditionally and systematically been disempowered by the system. They've been told officially and unofficially that they are less than fully whole here in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Now, this is the start part of the sermon where I start to lose you, and I need to tell you, stay with me, it gets better. Not immediately. Muslim, assume you'll be profiled or worse. Person of color, do I even need to say, assume you'll be stopped by the police and you'll be lucky if you get home in one piece. A woman, others will lay claim to your reproductive rights. Gay, lesbian, bi, queer, genderqueer, or otherwise varying from the binary, and I'm in that mix, consider yourself put on notice that your life matters less. All we need to do is look at what's going on in the southeastern states right now, where state after state is implementing not only punitive but dangerous laws against our LGBTQ brothers and sisters and siblings. This is not the land of the free and the home of the brave that we dream of. And yet there's this notion of American exceptionalism, that this country is better than others. This notion persists. And we hear from the pulpits, make America great again. I'm sorry, when was America great? Did I miss that part? When had this nation come close to living its ideals? And that's where we find ourselves right now, with inequality, racism, xenophobia, and bias as pervasive as it has been in recent times. As the schism between the haves and the have-nots, between the liberals and the conservatives, between the power base and the electorate, gets ever wider. And that loss of hope, and I know I don't need to tell you this, that loss of hope can feel devastating. And we feel compelled to choose sides. We feel compelled to find someone on whom to pin our hopes and dreams. And I want to offer you the words of a woman who isn't even typically a correspondent, but I love what she wrote. She wrote, at some level, the 2016 presidential race isn't about who's going to become president. It's about what we're going to become as a country. We clearly don't know the answer. We do know one thing, though. People are confused. People aren't confused because they're stupid. People are confused because the social contract is a mess. The symbols and shortcuts we use to tell us who stands for what is also a mess. And to make matters worse, those taking clear stances, and I'm not naming names, but those taking clear stances on what the social contract should be aren't necessarily the ones that can get the hard work done. People don't like confusion. People like certainty, and nothing fits better than someone or something that offers complete absolutes. So this election isn't about who the president will be. This election is about who we're going to be as a country. And I don't think it's unrealistic to say that we're a scared people craving certainty. I heard a report recently that 650,000 people, 650,000 and growing, are on a waiting list to move to Canada if their political candidate does not become president. I don't know how Canada feels about it. Clearly the level of fear, individual and communal, is high. Because this isn't about the next president, it's about finding our way as a country. A colleague of mine, I called her and said, I know you preached on this, what did you say, what did you figure out? And she has a systems theory analysis of it. And she says that the current climate of agitation and unrest is a counterbalance to the perception of the progressive agenda of the last 8 years. That all of this conservatism is trying to come back from those years of progressive gains. And undoubtedly, that's in part true. I think it's likely true that the sense that liberalism has ruled the roost for 8 years. But there's more to the story. We've been bifurcated for so many years, red and blue states no longer in conversation, but at polar differences, legislative bodies at standstills because they've forgotten how to work together, and whole parts of our judicial system at a standstill because politics thwarts the process, and on and on and on. So we know the social contract, what binds us together as a country, has come apart. How do we find a way back together? So much to my surprise, I circled back to the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Because that's the call. I mean, the call has always been there. We intend to be in this together. We yearn to be a nation held together by these shared values. We seek to extend true liberty and justice for all. And that's the beauty of a democracy. There isn't one right answer. There isn't one right way of responding. Much like Unitarian Universalism, there's room for divergent views. But the intention is for us to be in conversation with each other rather than solely in conflict with each other. So one more story on that note. I took a shuttle from my home to an airport a couple weeks ago. And the driver let me know early on in the ride that as a Republican, he felt a little unseen here in Southern California. And I'll admit my internal response was a little less than fully charitable. Both because I felt trapped with the other, and because I immediately mentally categorized him in less than generous ways. I caught myself. I took a couple of deep breaths, and I said, my guess is that you and I have different politics, but I'd like to hear more about what you believe and why you believe it. And he looked back at me rather shocked, but wanting the opening. And he proceeded. And what followed was really hard to listen to at times. He said a lot of things I don't agree with. But he was respectful, and he asked me a number of times, do you want me to continue? And I kept saying, yes, please continue. And as I listened, I heard the fear and the pain. I heard a dad wanting to protect his kids. I observed a man passionately committed to his ideals. I witnessed his struggle to make sense of graft and corruption in politics. And I was with a man yearning for something better. Like many, he broke my heart because he said, I'm so glad I won't be alive to see how bad this gets. And then he went on to talk about welfare and about immigration and about how if you work hard enough, you can achieve the American dream, which we all know is not true. Well, I know it's not true. I shouldn't speak for you. But then we found a topic on which we share substantial common ground. We talked about the overdevelopment of public lands. As you heard, I worked in the environmental field, he was an engineer, and we just started talking. We talked about the legacy for the generations that followed. We talked about what has been and what might be. Because underneath everything that appeared to separate us was a kindred spirit in so many ways. When I stopped internally fighting this man, we found connection. And we went on to talk about term limits and lifetime politicians, about the role of lobbyists, for a real need for Washington, D.C. to change the way that business is done. We got personal. We spoke of the desire of feeling middle-aged, of the want to remain meaningful throughout one's life. When I saw the person, and not just the political affiliation, connection ensued. And that's the best tool we have, gentleness and compassion, both for ourselves and for each other. But I don't want to minimize this. Compassion for ourselves is necessary, because this work of meeting the other, of really meeting the other non-reactively, it is incredibly hard work, and it takes a lot of practice. And then to extend that compassion outward, to see the other as fully human, to see their inherent worth and dignity, through our own layers of fear and pain, that's harder yet. Which I'm sorry to say makes it entirely the practice to which we are called. Because we are resistant, because that is the point of resistance, this is the work we need to do. As Unitarian Universalists, as this religious tradition, I hear us so often speak freely of caring for those more marginalized than ourselves. Maybe it's our queer brothers and sisters, or those in prison, or those being deported, or Black Lives Matter. We know that call to heal the world. We can learn to be more generous when it comes to politics. We are here not only to speak truth to power, but to build a world in which our love expands ever outward. It's easier to extend love to those clearly in need than it is to those whose views we most intensely disagree with. As I was writing this, I heard the words of author Russell Barkley, and he's talking about kids here, but it applies. And he says, those that need our love the most will ask for it in the most unloving of ways. Those who need our love the most will ask for it in the most unloving of ways. And I'm also influenced by author Karen Armstrong and her worldwide charter for compassion that she began several years ago. Here's her two-line mission statement. Join to make compassion a clear, luminous, and dynamic force in our polarized world. Embrace the compassion revolution. That's it. If you remember four words I said today, embrace the compassion revolution. In this divided time, use whatever and whomever calls you forth to offer compassion. That begins with meeting anyone and everyone where they are. Whether it's a new congregant finding a safe space here in this room, or someone who challenges every belief you hold most dear. We are called to no less than that. We are called to building a republic for which it stands one nation under God, maybe not under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. May we be worthy of this task. Blessed be.